Today is Monday, February 3rd. We have invited testimony, and we are privileged to have Mr. Rocky King back with us again, continuing with private market health insurance overview, employer-sponsored insurance. I think today we're going to talk a little bit about MSAs and other service deliveries. Staff have any questions or business they want to...
No, Chair.
Proceed ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool and the Insurance Pool Governing Board. And the kind of two agenda items that I want to cover today, I know today's the last day before you get into the Department of Human Services, but I want to talk a little bit about MSAs and for just a few minutes give you some background on them, and then dig into an overview of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which is FIAP. And I believe it was Representative March asked some questions last week on the MSAs, and I have handed out to you, if you can put in front of you, and we'll go through this, a article put out by the Council on Affordable Health Insurance covering MSAs. It says MSAs are not FSAs or not HRAs. I'm going to add, are not POPs, and I'll talk about POPs in a few minutes. But the second page of that gives you kind of a comparison of MSAs, which are medical savings accounts, FSAs, flexible spending accounts, very much like dependent flexible spending accounts where you can set aside child care dollars, HRAs, which are called health-related arrangements. And not on here are Section 125 plans, which we in the industry sometimes call POPs, P-O-P-S, and that's a premium-only plan. Let me just kind of go through, using a very simple example, the differences between the four of those. First of all, let me just talk about POPs, which isn't on here. Section 125 plan is nothing more than a way for the employee to pay the premium for their health insurance through pre-tax dollars. It's a premium-only plan. No other health care expenses. The employer sets up a Section 125 plan. They put in $100. The employee puts in $100 or whatever the arrangement is between the employee and the employer. And it is pre-tax dollars. So that $100 employee contribution, let's assume their total taxes are $50 or 50%, that $100 contribution saves them basically $50 in taxes because they don't have to run that through gross income. So that's a POP. Nothing more than running the premium through so you make sure and pay for your health insurance with pre-tax dollars. The medical savings account can be owned by the individual or the employee. And that is at the the individual employee. Contribution is made either by the employer or the employee. But it can't be both. So let's say you have a $2,000 deductible plan. The employer can put in $2,000 into that MSA, or the employee can put in $2,000. It's really the employer's decision at that point. It's owned by the employee, which basically means that from then on, any interest occurs or any interest earned in the MSA, or if that person was to leave employment, they own that MSA. That MSA follows them. They can withdraw from that for medical payments. They can also withdraw it just to get the cash, but they're subject to both tax and a 15% penalty if they withdraw it for other than medical payments. So it's really an account, employee or employer. It will roll over, meaning that you can put money in every year and it can build up. And at the age of 65, you can withdraw it with no penalty. You'll have to pay tax, but no penalty on it. So very similar to an IRA to some degree. That's different than the flexible spending account where, let's say, you have a $1,000 deductible plan and you think you're going to spend $1,000.
Rocky, let me interrupt you just for a second. If the employer puts $2,000 in your MSA and you leave to go to work for a competitor, does that money follow you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that does accrue to the employee. And that'll be different than the HRA, which we'll talk about in a minute. In the FSA, flexible spending account, I think most of us are familiar with that. If you have a $1,000 deductible plan or a $500, we'll say it's a $1,000, and you think you're going to expend $1,000, you can actually put it into the flexible spending account, and as you incur your copayments or other little expenses, then you can submit those to the administrator, who will reimburse those to you. Again, it's pre-tax dollars, so you take it out of your paycheck, pre-tax, put it in there, and you're able to withdraw it. The problem is it's spend it or lose it. So at the end of a year, if you've only spent $500, you lose $500. So you've got to know exactly what you're spending. And for someone who had a child in daycare who left the daycare halfway through the year, you can leave a lot of money on the table if you don't spend it, and it doesn't accrue to the next year.
Doesn't roll over.
By the way, on the MSAs, groups of 50 or below, 50 and above, they have some amendments now they're looking at, but it's basically for groups of 50 and below. Oregon has not been very successful in putting a lot of MSAs out there, because generally most carriers did not want to get into the market because it was an experiment. Now that it looks like it's well established, we've got some carriers. Maxie McKibben from the insurance division reports that two carriers now filed MSA plans and either have or will soon begin offering those in the market, 50 and less employees.
Mr. Chair.
Small question. FSAs, are they also commonly called cafeteria plans? You heard that phrase?
You can use you can use these as a part of cafeteria plans.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and I guess that was kind of to my question, was what's the difference between an MSA and a cafeteria, other than the front loading of it? I mean,
Chair, Representative Cruz, cafeteria plan may be a selection of two or three plans, how you spend your dollars, as opposed to an insurance plan or mechanism specifically. And I'll ask Peggy or Maxie.
I can make a real quick comment on it. I think on our cafeteria plan, for example, you can use your money for things such as life insurance and other products other than medical insurance.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America. Representative Cruz, would you repeat your question?
What's a cafeteria plan? Obviously, I thought there was maybe more similarities between that and MSA than I thought. So,
A cafeteria, Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, cafeteria plan is an umbrella term that is used in the benefits world, and you can have different kinds of components in a cafeteria plan. So you can have the POP, the premium only can be one component. You can have a flexible spending account that is another component. You can have the life insurance component that Representative Merkley. So what happens when the employer puts the plan together, the idea is that you have X amount of dollars that can be placed in one program versus another. And then, in addition, in the FSA, if the employee wants to put money into the FSA to cover expenses that would not otherwise be covered by their benefit plan, they can contribute themselves to that particular account. Good example, in addition to covering deductibles, would be, if you didn't have a vision option in your plan and you knew you were going to get glasses, so you'd figure out how much you thought you were going to spend on your glasses and put that amount of money in there. And that would be payable on a pre-tax basis. The other thing that you see actually in both the FSA and the HRA is that those monies can be spent for anything that is an allowed deduction under the insurance and under the Internal Revenue Code as a health expense. And oftentimes benefit plans don't cover all of the things that are also included or deductible under the Internal Revenue Code.
So is the cafeteria a defined contribution plan? And I guess I'm still not quite understanding exactly what that is. It's, you're saying that all of these could be part of a cafeteria plan. So, and clearly, the cafeteria is a large system type of mechanism. Let's say Multnomah County has cafeteria. I think they do. And so Multnomah County says to their employees, this is our, what we're putting in, and you can choose where it goes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, probably the easiest way of thinking of this is that when the term cafeteria plan came into existence, there weren't as many options out there. And so the term cafeteria plan went into, was coined before you had MSAs and HRAs. And so typically speaking, there were only a few items that could go into it, a cafeteria plan, and they are all related to the Internal Revenue Code regarding health insurance benefits. What is complicating for you now is that you know the term cafeteria plan and you know this FSA, but what has been added to it is the MSA and the HRA, and what you're seeing is an expansion of the different options that are available in the employer community. And frankly, they're all trying to get to the same point, and that is to come up with ways to make healthcare more affordable and trying to treat them on a pre-tax basis insofar as possible.
Right.
And so these two latter type of options are additions that are trying to meet a need. Now, you can say yes, that this is driving one towards the idea of a defined benefit plan, but that they weren't necessarily tied to that when they were initially developed.
Well, I was thinking more, it sounded more like a defined contribution than defined benefit. But
In effect, Representative Cruz, that may be how some folks are regarding it, but that was not the explicit purpose at the outset. And going back to the FSA plan, for example, if you have two individuals in a family that have dual coverage, you could have one that would opt onto the spouse's coverage and then get cash back, because you can do cash back in lieu of health insurance premium contributions, and put a certain amount of that premium amount into your FSA to cover, for example, the glasses that I just mentioned.
Keep asking questions, because I'm still confused.
It is, again, that when you started out, the cafeteria plan was something an employer, in fact, when I started doing this, an employer would offer to employees. And frankly, at that juncture, there were people who believed that you could save money by allowing employees to opt out of their health insurance coverage. And
so you opt out of what, Peggy?
Their health insurance coverage.
Okay.
And they would take a portion of that money and put it into an FSA to cover expenses that weren't going to be covered by their benefit plan. As health insurance has become so expensive, what you're finding now is that employers that are increasing copays and deductibles and taking a look at benefit modifications are looking more towards these other kind of tax structures to get employees more engaged in paying attention to what the cost of the service are or other health insurance, as well as giving them more options for paying for services on a pre-tax basis.
Couple just quick comments. So
wait, before you get going, we've all been waiting here trying to figure out if you really did have dinner with Colin Powell. Anything else you have to say is of very little relevance.
You would like a 10-second report on that?
I just want a yes or a no.
This I got as close as from here to here, because he skipped lunch and went directly to the podium.
That's close enough. Go ahead. You have something germane to say.
My wife has a cafeteria plan at Providence, and the way it was presented to us is that employees had very different needs, so rather than say, we're going to give you health insurance, they were say instead, we're going to give you an X amount of money you can spend on a variety of different things. Maybe you want enhanced disability insurance, maybe you want long-term health insurance, or a life insurance,
or maybe you want to buy one of many different types of health plans. And so there must be about, I don't know, 20 different options the way we could spend funds in that cafeteria plan. It's a big form we fill out every year. But that's my impression of it. It's just a kind of smorgasbord of options, and you have a lot of, you decide how you want to spend it.
Your insurance dollar.
It's your insurance dollars, yeah.
Including life insurance.
Yes.
So if you're healthy, you don't buy the health insurance. Increases the adverse selection issue.
Well, they make it a little more complicated, because if you choose certain health plans, they also kick in some extra money related specifically to the health care. So it ends up being not quite as simple as a straight, here's your money, you can spend it any way you want. So, for example, if you opt out of health insurance completely because a spouse has coverage, you don't get quite as much money put into your cafeteria plan as you do as if you take insurance from them.
Okay, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I actually understood Merkley.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, following up on Representative Merkley's comments, when the cafeteria plan concept was initially introduced, it was a lot simpler. And what has happened is that plan managers and benefit managers realized that there was some adverse selection associated with the choices that were placed on the table. And so the more sophisticated plans are actually taking a look at how they array the choices so as to continue to give the employees a wide variety of choices, but also at the same time try and minimize the full exposure that they might otherwise have.
Okay, I'm in a cafeteria, and I have I'm young, and you're going to have to really stretch your imagination for that one, but and I've got a bunch of kids, and I'm looking at what's offered, and I say, you know, I want all this dental, and I want all, you know, my kids have bad eyes, it's hereditary, you know, so I'm taking dental and vision and leaving some other things uncovered. And then, for example, you know, let's say I use everything up there and I don't have any primary care insurance, and then I need that service. What happens? Is that just out of my pocket and tough luck if I don't do it? Or is the cafeteria model, I mean, this Providence or whoever I'm working for that's offered me this, is there any liability from them for the things that I chose not to cover that I end up needing? Did that make any sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, this is this black hole of insurance discussion, but what I will tell you, let's say that you have dual coverage, or that you've opted out of your health insurance coverage because your spouse has coverage.
Okay.
And let's say for whatever reason your spouse loses the coverage and you don't have this underlying plan. What that happens then under actually federal law, that constitutes what they call a qualifying event. So you would then be able to opt back into your employer's plan that you had declined previously. So the idea is to assure that you have some basic coverage. And the assumption going into this, of course, is that you had, you know, some form of general health insurance. Otherwise, you wouldn't have entirely opted out of it. And as I say, that under a different federal law, you will be able to sign up again without any kind of a waiting period, any kind of a pre-existing period, and get back into a general health insurance plan.
But this is, I mean, assuming it's a defined contribution system, and I've looked at all of the options that are in this menu, and I have made a calculated decision on what I'm going to need, and I have expended all the resources I have available on that set of options, and then it turns out I needed something else. What happens? I'm not talking about a spouse having an alternate plan or anything. This is what I've got. So, I mean, is the system liable for the things I chose not to do, or is it all on me?
Representative Cruz, I guess there are a couple of ways. When I take a look, or when I've looked at the way employers have structured their plans,
okay,
one of the things that they try and assure is that the individual has some underlying form of health insurance coverage. In other words, you know, you'd have to have a bare bones plan before you could get, or you had dual coverage. So, you know, it is possible that an employer would say to you, you don't have to have any core benefit plan, basic benefit plan. You can go spend your money on XYZ. But generally speaking, when these programs are structured, they try and avoid that as an option. So you, while you may have put all of your emphasis on some different kinds of services, one of the underlying concepts is that you would have a basic benefit plan.
Okay.
And
okay.
Then on this other situation that I was describing, if you were depending upon your spouse's coverage...
For the basic benefits.
For the basic benefits, and that spouse lost the coverage for whatever reason, there are other federal provisions that allow you to get back into the basic benefit plan so that you've not... You know, you've not lost access. Now, in the case that you were describing, say you never took a basic benefit plan, where you're going to end up is in Rocky's high-risk pool, you know, with your six-month pre-existing condition. So ultimately, that would be the fallback position if under your scenario.
But what you're saying is as this has gotten more sophisticated and more complicated, most companies offering cafeteria have put some... put kind of floor on the thing is you have options but you got to take this and then you have options above that. So there is a basic benefit package with options on top of the basic benefit package. Okay.
So it's just an iteration of what Representative Merkley was saying. It's just evolved into this floor, basic benefits, and here's some options on the side. Is that a fair way of saying that? Just for the record, I mean, for those in attendance, he is not married. He only has one child.
Two.
And he is so old that he used to go to Who concerts back before their original drummer died of a drug overdose. So that's how old we're talking over here. Okay, two
children. Mr. Chair,
didn't you have some privacy legislation you wanted to introduce, Representative Cruz?
Representative
Anderson. I did, I think, for Samet. You're saying essentially that there's a floor of protection there, but if, for instance, Representative Cruz had chosen long-term care or dental care and used all of the dollars available, that he would have the chance to come back in and push those off and buy the basic care, or is he getting all of them?
Well, I had this understood until you asked that question.
I understood you to be saying he had the right to come back in at some time to get what was most needed, most basic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, a couple of clarifications, I guess. The one is that there's not any sort of legal requirement that there be a base plan associated with these. Employers and benefit managers do that just as a prudent course of business, taking a look at how they manage their overall risk for the group. In the case that you're suggesting, the access back to this basic plan would be independent of the, you know, putting all the money into dental, vision, or whatever. And so those kinds of options, those kinds of commitments, money that you put into that plan would continue. Because typically the way that it happens is you have X amount of dollars withheld from your paycheck on a monthly basis. It's either going into an MSA or towards some sort of a premium contribution. Your access back to this basic health plan, assuming that you'd lost it through other mechanisms, would be independent of that, and you would have to pay, or those premiums would have to be paid over and above whatever else you're channeling into the medical, dental, and all that sort of thing.
So if you're over the amount that was originally allotted, the employee has to pay, or the employer picks up for them if they're, I see. So there would be paying extra.
Right.
Okay, I got another question.
Okay.
Why Peggy's there. I mean, one of the problems I see, number one, in the more complex world with more choices, is cafeteria as attractive as it used to be? But the other question is, that brought up by Representative Anderson's question, like in an MSA, you have a choice. It's either employer or employee puts the money in. FSA is basically employee, HRA, employer, but in a cafeteria, can it be a mix? Can there be an employer and employee contributions to that?
Yes.
So that is the one flexibility cafeteria has that these others don't? Or is that not quite
cafeteria
accurate?
Cafeteria plan, Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, is a benefits term, as I said, that's an umbrella. So you can have, using what you have in mind, sort of a defined contribution approach to things, and you would call that, under that defined contribution approach, you could actually have an MSA or an HRA, and if the employer still wanted to call that a cafeteria plan, they could. Cafeteria plan only means that you've got choices.
Okay, but if an employer and an employee can both contribute to a cafeteria, could the company at that point, I mean, how could that happen and then buy an MSA with it unless it becomes a single pot of money at the point of the cafeteria and then underneath that it can all go into an MSA?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, let me try to do an example.
Okay.
I'm an employer. You folks all work for me. This is really
I want to raise.
Take the rest of the day.
That is true, sir. True. We do.
I'm going to give you $500 a month.
Okay.
And out of that, you can buy one of two health plans.
Okay.
An MSA or a full-blown HMO plan.
Okay.
One costs $100, one costs $300. I don't know. You also can choose dental, vision, and long-term care. Now, if you did the best of every one of those, it's going to cost you $600, and you'd have to put another $100 in. So I'm only giving you $500. But let's say the MSA actually left some money on the table because it's cheaper because all I'm paying for as the employer is the high-deductible plan. If you choose that MSA, you got to put $2,000 in. I can put the $2,000 in, or you can put the two, but we can't commingle what we do under that MSA.
Right.
Now, the employer can pay for the insurance product. But what you get to do is look around at all those plans, add them all up. How much do I want to give above what you give, or if I don't want to give any, what's the minimum I can get by with? You make a wrong decision, and there's no other what they call the qualifying event, death, marriage, and all that stuff, spouse losing. Forget about those. If you make a bad decision, you don't choose dental? No. If all of a sudden you have to go to the dentist and it's mid-year, you're not going to say, knock me there, give me the dental. It's just like your PEB plan. You're stuck with it unless there's a qualifying event. So the MSA may be one way to fund that, because one nice thing, if I'm healthy, maybe I want to do an MSA, put some extra bucks in there, because I get to roll those if I don't spend them. Now, the difference between an MSA and an HRA, health-related arrangement, not an account, is that an MSA, I can put the money in or the employer, and it belongs to the employee. Under the HRA, only the employer can put the money in there, and it belongs to the employer. So if I quit as an employee or I get fired, I lose all that money. It's actually not even put in it. It's just an arrangement where up to a set dollar amount, they'll agree to pay and reimburse me for my expenses that aren't covered by the plan. FSAs and HRAs some people believe, increase health care expenditures, because in both cases you lose it if you don't use it. FSA, remember I put $500 at the end of the year, I lose it. So I'm going to spend that.
Right.
HRA belongs to my employer, doesn't belong to me. I'm going to leave employment at some point. I can't roll it. I might as well spend it. MSAs make a little bit more sense from the standpoint of, whoops, if I don't spend it, I get to keep it. And at age 65, given interest, I could even have a pot of money. And I can withdraw it. I just have to pay a penalty. So there's some differences. Does that kind of wrap up that piece of it? Peggy and I and Maxie McKibben would be happy to come back at the end of all your little presentations and put together a more detailed on this if you would like.
I think what is confusing about this is the chronology of the evolution of these different kinds of tax code plans, and I think Rocky and I can sit down and work out a couple of examples so you can take a look at a menu and then see what it would look like under the different choices.
Whether there, Mr. Chair, what are the modifications? I mean, there's changes happening in MSA.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, there are a couple of them. MSAs are looking at groups of 50 and above.
Okay.
Expanding the number of MSAs that are allowable within the country. I think it was 750,000. They're looking at removing that cap. MSAs, there's actually some proposed legislation.
Okay, this is all proposed legislation at this point?
I believe it's still proposed.
Okay.
Under FSAs, they're actually looking at allowing you to roll over, not lose, up to $500 a year. That's flexible spending account, which I think would be very productive because it's very hard to guess what your medical expenditures are going to be during a given year. They're looking at allowing people to at least keep some of that into the next year. It's another proposal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, having been a benefits manager, seeing the claims that roll in at the end of a plan year under an FSA is a very enlightening experience. I mean, they're, as Rocky says, you know, people are very much committed to spending every nickel they have in the account.
Well, I'm personally, Mr. Chair, excited about the concept of removing the caps on MSAs so that we can do it in the real world instead of the minimalist atmosphere we've had up till now. So,
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On these flexible spending accounts, where if you don't use the money, it's your money that you're putting into account, but if you don't use it, the employer gets to keep it. At least that's what it says in this article here.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, I believe it goes back to the plan.
Oh, okay. Well, this says while employees contribute the money, employers get to keep any unspent balance at year's end. So perhaps that's mistaken. But if that's accurate,
where are you in that? Point that out for
the top of the second column, the second paragraph, starting with "But the biggest downside of FSAs." Let's see. And second sentence: while employees contribute.
Hi, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley. Typically what happens, you know, these have to be maintained as a fiduciary plan, and what will happen is that those unused portions are typically rolled back into the plan itself to help offset the cost of the plan for the next year. So, and in fact, if the employer wanted, they could actually make an individual distribution at the end of the year of all the unused amounts in there, but typically speaking, they'll just put it back into the plan to reduce the cost for the next year. And those two options are allowable under the Internal Revenue Code.
So, Ms. Chair, so the employee will get some benefit, but it's aggregate and hard to define because...
Unless he left.
Well, no, but assuming that most of the employees had money left in their side and it rolls back in, it reduces the cost next go-around?
For the group.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I've never seen an employer do an individual distribution of the leftover assets.
No. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying if it rolls back in to finance the next year, it's going to lower the cost, but it's in an aggregate, and so it'd be hard for an employee to see that he was getting, and, you know, this person spent all his, so I'm subsidizing him sort of thing, so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, and an example of that is the state of Oregon that does a flexible spending accounts for dependent care. Now, let's say there's a 1% charge of administration. Any money that's left over may go back in to reduce the administrative cost, which benefits in the state of Oregon as a whole, but it doesn't benefit the individual in that they get any money.
Mr. Chair, to follow up on this, it's a very interesting situation that an individual faces because you're basically gambling on what your health care expenses will be. There's something very similar with the daycare savings account, where if we put money into the daycare savings account and we don't spend it at the end of the year, we lose it completely. And I just thought it's a very torturous arrangement for citizens to face.
Is that a question?
No, it's an expression of frustration.
No, to Lori. Oh, okay.
Just a quick comment and make sure I'm with you on both on all these plans, because I would say that the healthcare industry's methods of financing healthcare have become so Byzantine that even physicians who are supposed to know what they're talking about half the time are wrong. I don't know how a consumer can pick their way through something like this. It's just ludicrous. But on an FSA, which my company uses as an example, I think the reality is people take a guess of how much they're going to put into it, and as the end of that year comes up, they spend it all down one way or the other.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay? Problem here is the FSAs were already set up for two things. One, to make them tax exempt, because corporations can buy health insurance tax exempt, and we do commonly do that, but individuals can't. So that would level the playing field. And more importantly, to help hold down health care costs, because it's your money, you're responsible for it, and you'll spend your money a little more carefully. And that's been eliminated now with all of these, because it's a spend or lose it type of thing. And so people spend it, and it drives health care costs up, not down. It's an example, from my point of view, of the government once more getting involved and just screwing it up. And that's really concerning to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I think the article that I gave you that precedes this says that that's not true under the MSA, because you can roll it. But the FSA and the HRA do, in some people's belief, raise health care costs as opposed to lower them. That's one of the reasons why you're seeing on federal legislation or federal proposals to have some of that MSA, at least a portion of that, being able to be rolled over.
But
okay.
I see Representative Bates down. By the way, let the record show that Representative Dr. Bates acknowledged that he's wrong 50% of the time.
In the legislature.
Chair, I can tell you
the legislature.
Yeah.
Not in my life as a physician.
Yeah.
I hope not.
But I think with the MSA, I mean, the whole thing is about incenting people to be more vested in their own health care, and I think under the structure of the MSA with a rollover provision, that's their money, and they can roll it over. Why wouldn't that? I saw you shaking your head. I don't know if you're just shaking your head at the FSAs and the HRAs, but it appears to me that the MSA, at least the way it's currently structured, you know, allows people to incent themselves in their own health care. Do you disagree with that?
I would agree it's a step in the right direction. It's almost like the government puts a poison pill in each and every one of these plans. The MSA is a high deductible. I think it's for 50 and less employees. And, you know, the employer can put money in or the employee can put money in, but not both. You can't match it up with somebody. They put all these restrictions right in there that just screw it up.
Well, Dr. Bates, Ted Kennedy, it was Ted Kennedy's bill. Do you expect it to be good?
Don't start off with Ted Kennedy with me, okay?
But okay, at least it's a step in the right direction. Yes. You understand?
I agree it's a step in the right direction. Yes. I wish they'd really clean it up.
Well, good chair. If I may, that was supposed to take 5 minutes of my.
How'd we do?
So I am going to now cover FEOP, and I am going to do that in about a half hour's worth of time instead of an hour. And what I'd like to do is run through it very rapidly and then come back and do some of the questions. Otherwise, I'm afraid that we'll get bogged down on slide two, and I pulled Rick that you can't invite me back for the fifth day in a row. So may I have you turn to page 52. Slide two. It's in the last section, which is section 15 of the book.
52 or 55?
52.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about IPGB, Insurance Pool Governing Board, for a quick minute, and then right into FIA. IPGB has three main functions.
IPGB.
Insurance Pool Governing Board. Has three primary functions. The first is marketing, outreach, and information program. The second is House Bill 3126, I'll talk about, or second, and the third is FIOP. Marketing, information, and outreach. We do agent and stakeholder training, agent referral program. You get a business that calls us that says, I want to do an MSA. What do you do? Remember I said right at the beginning, I'm not a great technical person, but I know who to call. Now, our office is the same way. When a business calls us and says, I'm interested in something, we say, where do you live? We can give them a carrier to call, or we can give them an agent in their local community. We have a group of about 260 agents that go through our training, It's a voluntary thing for them to do, and once they've gone through the training and they meet the certain requirements about errors and admissions insurance and a few things, we'll put them on an agent referral list. So if Ms. Chair, you called me from Tumalo and said, I've got a small business, I want to do an MSA, I would say Patrick O'Keefe in Bend is an agent and he's on our referral list. Here's his phone number, or I'd call Patrick and give him your phone number. If you're in Albany, I'd have you call with Rebel, or Portland, Steve Doty. We have agents throughout. Plus, we have bilingual agents, and we have the ability to identify some agents who aren't a part of the referral program who have some of the other language, Vietnamese or Chinese. Publications. You've seen a lot of the publications we do for business. Every month, we mail out over 3,000 information brochures about health insurance to businesses who inquire with, or new and emergency businesses that inquire to the state business information center about doing business in the state. We provide information. Customer service. We get in our office between 1,600 and 1,700 calls a week. And this is from individuals, help me. This is from businesses, help me. This is from stakeholders who have information needs that they want to connect up to, other state agencies. Just, and this has grown in the last 3 or 4 or 5 months from an average of 600 to 700 calls to almost 1,600 to 1,700 calls a week. We have
That's 350 calls a day.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Mr. Chair. We have 3 or 4 customer service staff, and some of these are 20-minute calls, and some of these are 5-second calls. We're having a tough time keeping up. And this is, I think, a function of the expansion of FEOP. It's the function of what's going on in OHP, Medicaid program, in terms of a large number of the people are losing benefits or losing coverage. It has to do with a large number of employers that are having to make tough decisions. I'll tell you, I will hand it to those salary level 14 and 15 folks that are there answering those phones, because they hear from people that are dying as well as businesses that are closing down and having to point them in a variety of directions. That's the first thing we do. It's a small part of our program, but a very, very important one. Give you an idea of agent and stakeholder training. Since November 1, I'm trying to remember these numbers here, we have trained in 18 cities about 450 agents around some of the insurance market reforms and expansion that we're doing under FEOP. And I think, Kelly, correct me if I'm wrong, between 800 and 1,000 community and other state workers, AFS, DH, Department of Human Service workers around FEOP program. So almost 2,000 people have attended our training sessions just in the last 3 months. We've been there since 1990 doing this, and we will, I think, continue to see a lot of pressure until the economy gets better and some of these programs get settled in before we'll see that begin to die down. House Bill 3126, put forth by Mary Nolan last year, directed the IPGB to get back into plans, insurance plans for small uninsured businesses, to make it a cheap product, not subject to mandates, but it must meet the FEOP benchmark. Now, remember I told you when we talked about benchmark earlier, the FEOP benchmark has to equal basically what's offered in the market today. So what the law says is come and do something that's down here, even though it has to meet something that's up here. It's a paradox. We can't do it. So we're working with Mary Nolan. We got no money to do it anyway. We've kind of put it on hold because I'm sure the legislature and Representative Anderson, we talked about this a little bit, was going to look at some of the plans that they may want to put on the table to not just for IPGB, but the general market that may or may not include the different mandates. So while we do the marketing information and outreach, we're really put House Bill 3126 on hold until we see what kind of comes out of this initial start of the legislative session. And we've been working with Representative Nolan on that. Now to FEOP. Enacted 1997, general fund only. Here's $20 million. Go out and develop a model to subsidize low-income Oregonians to buy private health insurance. Understand that this was set up and started as a model. a model implies that you're going to put different wings on it and a different engine and a different tail, but we want to see how it works. And we want you to modify it as time goes to make it work, hopefully, even better. But it was out of some discussions around small businesses and the difficulty that many individuals that were working that didn't qualify for Medicaid, the difficulty they were having buying either individual health insurance or group health insurance because they simply couldn't afford their premiums. Yet these were the same folks, through their taxes, paying for people enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid and help support businesses' deductions for health insurance. Some people call them they're working poor. I just like to say Oregonians that are working that can't afford health insurance. And it was really designed to look at a model. We implemented May of 1998 with our first enrollments of July in 98. And I will tell you that ever since 1998 until this session, we got the waiver, we've been reduced every year because we're general fund only. So we started off with, we're going to do 15,000, then it was 7,500, then it was 5,500, now it's between 4,000 and 4,200, until the waiver came through 2519, which really pushed that higher. So we're on slide 56. House Bill 2519 passed last session, directed the state to submit waivers to the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services, referred to as CMS. Really three separate things. One, to look at flexibility within Medicaid program and by designing both the Oregon Health Plan Plus, which is for mandatory Medicaid individuals, Oregon Health Plan Standard, which is basically for childless adults or single parents, single adults or childless parents. And then the third section was FEOP, or the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. Gene Thorne, I think, is going to be here starting tomorrow. He's going to talk about the Medicaid portion of this, the Oregon Health Plan. So we'll just really look at FEOP at this stage. CMS approved this on October 15th after about 4 or 5 months of a lot of negotiations, both substantive as well as political. And we were told then to expand November 1st, 2002. Now, you don't find out on October 15th, 2 weeks before, and it actually wasn't accepted by us until October 28th, and have 50,000 people walk in the door November 1st, because first of all, you can't market it until you get it approved. So basically, very little marketing was going on. Secondly, we didn't know where the governor was yet on what the budget presentation or governor's recommended budget was, so we were going to kind of buy and go out and market something that you didn't know if it was going to be in the budget, which you wouldn't hear until December. So that November 1st date really meant just turn the key and start getting the federal match. It didn't mean this big influx of people coming in.
How about third, you didn't know where the budget was, alone what the governor was going to propose in his.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Let me talk about...
Hold on. We've got a question, Representative Anderson.
CMS is...
Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. When we first put this program on the table, we went before the legislature, and we wanted to lay out some principles. And we really kind of said, if you want us to do this, we all have to agree on these principles. And that will help then guide us to make sure we go down the trail that you want us to go down to. And those principles were to build on the strength of the current private market system. 2 million Oregonians get their care in the private sector. We really wanted to do the best we could to take the strength of that system. Secondly was this is not an entitlement. There's limited dollars. When they said 7,500 folks into the program, they meant it. And we did it in terms of dollars, not people. But when they said 20 million, they didn't mean 25 or 30. Don't come back for a rebalance. Here's the money. Live within that budget. We did that. It was a program that was supposed to foster independence and self-reliance. People that were enrolled in the program were going to have to take responsibility for copays and deductibles for obtaining private health insurance. This addresses an income group that has 400,000 or 500,000 people that have gone through this system that are buying health insurance, generally group. But it wasn't. It was really taking these group and saying, you've got to kind of do the same thing a lot of other folks are doing, but we're just going to give you a hand in doing it. Administrative simplicity and efficiency. I'll talk about this a little bit later, but one of the things we said is we're going to make this simple to get in and expect a fraud rate of 3 to 5%. We'll want to know everybody up front. If you want a fraud rate of 1%, then it's going to be administratively more difficult to get in. I'll talk about that in a few minutes because that's the one area that I think we've had the most difficult with.
Which is higher, correct me if I'm wrong, higher than your, quote, standard OHP fraud rate?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I think 5% would be higher than the standard OHP, but I'm not sure. But it was kind of, it's balancing, filling out an application that says, I'm poor, give me health care. And over here, putting in, you know, 400 pages of documentation to prove that you're deserving that health care. On one hand, you know you're going to have a lot of fraud. On the other hand, you know you're not. Where do you draw the line in between that makes it easy for the employer, for the individual, and the carrier, and the state to make sure that the right people are getting the dollars? And I'll just talk here for a minute. That's the place we failed the most, is to make it easy for everybody. When we first started off, we made it pretty simple. And then, very frankly, we had a lot of people sit down from my office, a lot of the auditors and appeals folks and the eligibility people that would say, you know, I know we said we're going to have a higher fraud rate, but I'm seeing some people, and it really angers me when we have limited dollars to see somebody that gets in that doesn't deserve. And if we would have just asked for this piece of information, we could have prevented that from happening. So we've had a tendency to go from very simple, very frankly, to getting a lot more complicated. An example of that is we now require tax returns. When we first started, we didn't require tax returns. The first year of operation, and Medicaid does not require them. In the first year of operation, we have random audits, and then we do all kinds of auditing we try to do. And one of our auditors came upon an individual that had some property by looking at their tax return that they'd never had put forward to us. So we sat around and did a lot of debate. That's a barrier. People having to make copies. This is low income. But we decided to ask the tax returns. We were amazed at the number of people who didn't return their applications on redetermination. And we were amazed at the number of tax returns we looked at, that it wasn't just the pay stubs or the bank account, but there were other assets and other property that showed up in tax returns that we weren't getting through the normal application process. So all of a sudden now we require tax returns. It's much more difficult, much more cumbersome. We feel better about going to the taxpayer and asking for money. But the reality is, for 95% of the folks, it's more hassle. So finding that balance as a state program so that the employer feels good, individual, we, carrier, is a tough balance to find.
Representative Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying for 95% it's a hassle, and the 5%, that 5%, was that costing us millions of dollars or thousands of dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we never determined, it never was at 5%. That's what we originally said, let's just assume 5%. Mm. Program managers back there, but it was less than 1% that we found. Less than 1%. I don't want to call it fraud or error, whatever you want to call it. So it wasn't costing us millions, and it wasn't costing us hundreds of thousands. What it was costing us, though, when you have a waiting list, is somebody getting into the program that deserves. And that's the balance that's really tough from an administrative standpoint to do.
So you, assuming you're covering 20,000 people, you're talking about 200 folks who were enrolled that shouldn't have been, that got weeded out when you went to a tax return, 200 people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, they're weeded out in a couple ways. One, by increasing the amount of verification we require for income and assets. And they were weeded out through the auditing process that we, the random audit where you look at, because we've always had the right to ask for whatever information we needed to support the application. Mm-hmm. In a random audit, you'll go and say, you know, we want to see some additional information. Or in appeals, when we'd be denied something, we would say, well, if you want to provide us this additional information, they would provide the additional information, and we'd go, well, wait a minute here. What's the city block that you own in Lafayette? You know, it doesn't show up on your wage. listen, 99% of the folks in this state are honest, hardworking, truthful, trying just to find a way to get in to see the doc. There's this other little group, and the balance you have to have is, what do you make the 99% go through to get to that one? And that's the balance we're trying to find.
Mr. Chair.
Because the more difficult you make it, the less of those 99 are going to be able to get through that maze.
Rocky, does your audit have to be a random audit, or could you kind of go by the smell test? In other words, if you get an application that just doesn't look right, could that be a trigger an automatic audit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, audit is after you're in the program,
right.
Eligibility before. I will tell you that I could not sit down and do that eligibility. I could 4 years ago, but these folks have been with us 1 or 2 years. They learn to feel. They look at that, and I don't know what it is, but it's just as much an art as it is a science.
Mm-hmm. I assume that, yeah.
The audit folks, it's much more of a science because they, 1 out of 20, look at it. They have a process. Eligibility worker, it's just amazing. And we talk to all our folks. Almost everybody's talked to, even though we have one central location, because you always have a question. And it's amazing what comes out of that. I have to give it to the eligibility folks. They've really learned to combine that art and science.
Okay,
doing
Mr. Chair, I guess my question would be, and I understand that there's an art to this and you get a feel for a job that you've been doing. Do you have a sense of how many, if you weren't requiring tax return, would they still be able to catch the folks that shouldn't be there, do you think? I mean, if we're talking 1%, that's pretty minimal to start with.
Now, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, the answer to that is would we be able to catch them anyway? And the answer is no, because once we started requiring tax returns in some of our auditing and appeals process, we were finding additional information out where they wouldn't have gotten them.
And let's let Rocky get through FEOP and then write your questions down. This is an important section, and I want him to be able to do full disclosure.
Mr. Chair, we got all night.
That's true.
Actually, we don't. We move on.
Okay, we're still on slide 57 on the principles. Extend coverage to the uninsured. There is a six-month period of uninsurance. Remember, the kind of core of some of this was let's get everybody under the tent. We'll worry about some of the equity issues later. It is inequitable to say you have to be uninsured for 6 months, but that was to keep people from dropping coverage just to come in and get the public dollar. Subsidies must be adequate. You can't take somebody that's making $900 a month and say, I'm going to give you $200, go out and buy a $400 health insurance plan for your family. You just can't. You have to make sure that the subsidies are adequate based on their income, take-home income. And finally, the one I keep talking about is promote equity and health care financing. I spent a lot of time going throughout this state. Angers a lot of low-income folks that they're out there working full-time, and you're making a minimum wage, 40 hours a week, single individual, and you don't qualify for Medicaid. So these folks out here working at McDonald's were angry that they had nothing. And I don't say some McDonald's provide health insurance, local decision. But some of them were very angry because through their taxes they were supporting folks, and yet they could not afford it. So those were the principles that we kind of bought into. The eligibility, easy. Oregon resident, citizen or qualified non-citizen. And Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, we do provide, they have to provide proof of Oregon residency through driver's license or for those that don't have a driver's license, that's the rental stuff. They have to be citizen or qualified non-citizen. Only because we have federal funds, we used to allow citizens of the U.S., but also non-citizens as long as they were legal residents of Oregon. But using federal funds, we're not able to do that right now. Without health insurance for 6 months, investments and savings less than $10,000. Medicaid is $2,000. CHIP children is $5,000. We chose $10,000, in concert and in consultation with the legislature as well as the Oregon Health Council, because our objective was to hope that people would earn more and save more so they could buy the house, buy the car, whatever it is. The reality is most people in the program, it's $2,000 or less. But we did not want to punish those people for trying to set aside some resources. Family income under 185% of federal poverty level. We look back 3 months, except for self-employed farmers, ranchers, and fishermen. They have different income streams than everybody else, so we look at some 12-month and 6-month averaging. Different than OMAP, we also provide for 12 months of eligibility as opposed to 6 months. When somebody comes into the program, one of the things that we have found in our discussions with stakeholders and especially our enrollees is that stability is very important to them. Now, the first question they asked me at a legislative session was, what happens if somebody wins the $1 million lottery the day after they're found eligible? I get on the phone to them and I tell them, congratulations, they will pay more in taxes this year than we will pay in subsidy. I am happy for anybody who gets a raise and earns more money. That is the whole objective of this program, is to give people a time out about not having to worry about health insurance and a chance to take care of their families and look at their economic well-being. FEOP designs, there are 4 subsidy levels, 95% subsidy up to 125% of the poverty level, and there is in Section 2 are the poverty levels, if you want to refer to them, the actual dollars amounts. 90%, and remember what I said earlier, is there's very little difference in disposable income from 100 to 115% of poverty because your social service and support systems go off. So your income goes off after 150. And there are some that argue that 185 is, it's kind of an arbitrary number. It's a political number of negotiation as opposed to at 185 you can't afford it and 185 you can't, or 184 you can't. It's just really a dollar peg political number. You probably could talk between 200 and 250%. People are struggling in this state, paying $700, $800 for family coverage every month. But it's the money we have. Program features 2519, 50-50 split of state resources between group and individual markets. That means approximately 3 group enrollments in for every individual. That'll create a problem I'll talk about in a few minutes. The idea there was we wanted to leverage employer contributions. Remember, out of that 200,000 or 150,000 people between 100 and 200% of poverty, maybe only 25 to 40,000 have group coverage. By doing this 3 group for one individual, you're leaving 125,000 people out of the mix. You must enroll in the group plan if offered. And if no group plan is available, you may enroll in the individual market. We have 7 carriers that we've certified as eligible for FEOP enrollees to purchase a plan from. Group and individual plans must meet a benefit benchmark, and that comes out of 2519, which said you can subsidize plans that are the most common in the market. And that, as I said earlier, is a $500 deductible plan in the old days, moving towards more of a $750 or $1,000 deductible plan today.
But that shell creates this 2519 said here, reality is here.
Mr. Chair, actually 2519 didn't peg a benefit plan.
Right.
It just said the most common offered.
Right.
But that most common offered is changing, and that's my first challenge that I list on slide 61, where the benchmark benefit plans are moving targets in both group and individual markets. 5 years ago, you saw a lot of $200 individual market plans. People can't afford those now, so they're buying $500. So that becomes our benchmark. So it isn't a plan that legislation identified. It was kind of what's the most common out there, which may or may not be good for the lower income folks. If you earn $5,000 a month doing an MSA or doing a $1,000 deductible plan, makes sense. If you're earning $6.93 an hour and somebody says, here's a $1,000 deductible plan, that takes care of the catastrophic stuff, but it doesn't take care of basically the day-to-day needs that you may or may not be able to afford. And that's the problem with the benchmark. I'm not saying get rid of it, just saying that there are some issues. Group enrollments are going to be tough. First of all, there's no one in the state that can tell me which employers have people that turn down coverage because they can't afford premiums. What are the industries? Is it Burns? Is it Portland? Is it Woodburn? Is it Turner, Oregon? Is it Astoria? So what we've done, great opportunity. We've got some Robert Woods Foundation money, and we're doing a very large grant, $200,000, to take a careful look at and a detailed look at Oregon's group market. And we hope that study will be ready May, June. It'll be the most comprehensive we've done in this state to find out how much they contribute, what are the wages, what kind of benefits are they buying, what do they contribute, who opts out, why do they opt out. We have a whole list of questions, and I actually have the RFP in one of the sections in there that you can look at later, and if there's a question that you want to ask that's missing, let us know, and we'll see if we can build it in early in the design. Navigation of private market maze. Representative Bates is really right. We have trouble getting through the private market maze, MSAs, HRAs, FSAs, you know, preferred provider, point of service. Low-income folks, it is tough. These are people that have very often not purchased private health insurance, and helping them through the maze. Here's the subsidy. Call an agent. Call a carrier. Fill out the app. Get turned down. Go to OMIC. Get in your group plan. Do qualifying event during open enrollment. All terms that the low-income have a very, very difficult time with. And that's why we have the agent referral program to try to team them up with somebody to help them through that process. A big challenge. Developing strategic relationships and linkages with employers and business groups. We, I think, at the Insurance Pool Governing Board have been very successful in working with organizations like AOI and the Restaurant Association, OMA, and the hospital groups, and trying to develop relationships. But it continues to be a challenge because very often there are competing needs and competing interests. On slide 62, administrative simplicity, I've talked about that. What's easy for us may not be for the consumer or the employer. Employers don't want a lot of hassle and more paperwork, yet we need certain pieces of information around their health benefit plan. We have to get some verification that the person works there. We have to get verification how much the plan costs and what the employee portion is. And so it's a challenge, and I've got a great group of folks and a lot of nice employers that are working with us, but it's something we have to be very careful of.
Is what you're needing considerably different than what workers' comp requires as far as base information?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I'm not sure what workers' comp requires.
No, because we fill out forms for workers' comp all the time on our employees, and it just kind of popped in. The question is, if we're filling out very similar forms with other state agencies, maybe that's worth looking at to see if one form could satisfy more than one need from the perspective of the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, something I'll look at. The only thing I'll offer is workers' comp forms are required. We're voluntary, and they can say no to us. That's one
at this point, they can say no. If this gets expanded, it may not be a voluntary thing.
Thank you, Big Brother. I was thinking the same thing, though.
One of the things we're hearing right now is what kind of political support and priority the program has in the current economic environment. It's tough to go to a business and say, go into partnership with us, set up these processes, enroll your folks, but by the way, we may have to tell you 2 months later if the program's gone. There's a lot of folks that are waiting to see what the legislature does before they're going to hop in, because once you get into this with your employees, whether it's one or five or two, it's a process, and it's a commitment on the employer's part, the individuals, and the states. And it's hard to go to the marriage altar if you don't know if somebody wants a divorce in the next 3 or 4 months. So we're having some challenge working with the business community until the legislature, I think, makes a decision whether we're going to move forward with this or not. Next one, a big one, reverse disparity between adult and private and public sector health care benefits. For 12 years, I've been going around this state talking with business groups, agents, carriers, and I've heard all the anger about the great benefits in OHP compared to the private sector. Well, you're reversing that. With the changes we're seeing in OHP standard, the copays and deductibles, the loss of mental health, dental benefits, the prescription drugs, and the cutbacks, for the first time for a group, not the Medicaid mandatory population, but for the adults, you're starting to see less benefits than the private sector. That's going to create another dynamic where I used to get the business people hollering at me, now I'm going to get the advocates hollering at the other end. So we got to be careful that we don't have bridges that force people into one system or the other just because of benefit decisions. And I don't know how to get there yet, but it's a challenge I think all of us have to think about. Administrative costs. I told the previous administration that at 4,000, 5,000 people, it did not make sense to continue the program because of the administrative costs. 25,000 people, which is what the November e-board or September e-board passed, it made sense, and we got our administrative costs down into the 7.5% or 8.5% area. The governor's budget, because of the economic downturn, where we're going to have about 14,000, I'm projecting an administrative cost, it's going to be above 10%. Once we get that all settled, a big challenge for us is going to have to be able to come back to you and say it was worth the dollar we spent in administration, given the $3 or $4 or $5 or $100 in actual subsidies. So that's going to be a challenge for us as we move down on the numbers because of the economic downturn. And finally, the inequity between those who have group available and those who don't. It makes good sense to pay $80 and put somebody in the group market rather than $180 and put them in the individual. Problem is, fewer people have the group market available than the individual market. And so there is an inequity. I got a 14,000 waiting list for the individual. I don't have any waiting list for group market. But again, if you don't do that 50-50 split, then my numbers, instead of 15,000, go down to 6,000 or 7,000. So it is a challenge, and it's one that we always have to give some consideration to. Interface between Medicaid state agency and the insurance pool governing board administering the subsidy program. Great challenge because they talk federalese, we talk private sector. Great opportunity because they know a heck of a lot we're trying to learn from their experiences of working with the populations that overlap. And they have great resources and a lot of committed staff to help us on the private side work better. Prospective versus reimbursement and group market. You have somebody that has a $300 that's going to be taken out of their paycheck. You want to give them the $300 before it's taken out, because if they're low income, they can't afford to wait 2 weeks to get that $300 back. On the other hand, you give them the $300 and they quit their job, they owe you $300. So we're trying to find, we did one way, we switched to one way, now we're switching back. And that's why we call ourselves a model, because we can do that. The wing didn't work, we're changing the wing a little bit. But it's tough when you're low income to have money taken out of your check and have to wait for some state agency who's promising to send it that they're going to return that in 2 or 3 days. Because if there's a delay, it's not like you and I where we just wait. It's food on the table for them. So it's part of that administrative simplicity. You give them money sometimes knowing that they'll take it and run. Very few, but a few. Or do you say, no, spend the money and we'll just reimburse you? We tried the first, didn't like the results. We're going to went to the second, that is, we'll just reimburse, and we're saying that's too big of a barrier for this group, and we're looking at going back and paying them up front, knowing that they may owe us 1 month's premium if they walk away. But in the long run, we think we'll be able to serve the most needy doing that. Employer-employee reimbursement options. We're working with employers to figure out a variety of ways. Some employers say, don't worry about the employee. We'll front the employee, just pay us back. So we're doing some things with employers and trying to be very flexible for those that would like to participate with us. And finally, part of the reason you can't do the individual market is because of its impact on the OMIP assessment. Let's say you take 1,000 people and you put in FEOP on the individual market. 200 of those, or 250, are going to end up in OMIP. OMIP, if you remember, about 60% of the cost is the premium. We don't mind doing that. But 40% of the cost is through the assessment. So you put 4,000 or 5,000 people in OMIP, and all of a sudden you're going to see the insurer's assessments go higher and higher and higher. So we've got to find a balance of how we can fund perhaps some of those folks without just necessarily being adverse to the OMIP assessment. And one of those, and Representative Cruz, I think we're in your hearing next week, I'm not sure if it's next week or not, is House Bill 2189, where we're going to use, the best we can, the insurer's assessment as a leverage to get federal dollars. So we're actually going to try, and that would reduce then that assessment for those enrolled to about a third. And that means that under the current bill, we could expand probably 3,000 or 4,000 people in the individual market without expanding the assessment. So we've got a bill before you that will allow us to do that. No time's running out. There are some waiver issues, services to children, well, child care, and immunizations. If a plan doesn't cover immunizations, we have to find a way to reimburse the individual for those immunizations. That's a federal requirement. We have a bill before the legislature that will be heard in the next few weeks, I believe, that will allow us to reimburse individuals when a health plan doesn't cover immunizations. There are some potential state funding issues with OHS.
Question on that, I think. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Even though you can get free immunizations through your local, or sort of free, through your local public health departments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's true in 90% of the state, and in those cases we actually have a list we're referring people to.
Okay.
But you start getting into rural areas, and I would rather have some of these folks drive 10 minutes down to the dock than an hour and a half to the local health clinic. So it's different in different communities. What happens to Medicaid? We're very much impacted that in terms of the waiver. If you give back the waivers on the Medicaid side, then that obviously jeopardizes the waiver on the FEOP side. And so whatever you do, or if you give back the waiver on the FEOP side, obviously that jeopardizes the Medicaid public portion. So whatever decisions are made about our program or Medicaid, we've got to make sure that we're kind of in sync on that. Let me talk about the program snapshot. I'm going to give you some figures because these have kind of changed, but our total enrollment right now is about 3,300 individuals, 3,336. We got down to about 2,700 just before we got the waiver, so we've come up about 600 since then. I've got over about 1,700 lives that have been approved for subsidy are in the process of enrolling in health insurance. It takes anywhere from 30 to 90 days, depending on group market, individual, to get enrolled once you've been approved. So I've got about 1,700 that have been approved, and I've got another 434 under review, and since in the last month we put on another 1,000 on the reservation list, which includes applications sent out and reservation lists. It's going to be a tough objective to get all the group people. It's going to take us a year, 12 months to 14 months. Individual will ramp it up as we ramp up the group, but it's going to be tough to get the group people in until we get through, I think, some of this legislative process and we get some of the political pieces and the budget pieces out of the way.
Mr. Chair? Yeah. Would you advocate for more flexibility than 50-50?
Mr. Chair, sorry, Representative Cruz?
Group and individual. Would you advocate for more flexibility than 50-50?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I think that the issue of the OMIF assessment is a key issue.
Okay.
Because you would kill all the programs if we, I think, unfairly...
But if we get Medicaid match there, that changes the dynamic, doesn't it?
Changes some of the dynamic.
Okay.
Representative Cruz, it becomes much more expensive if you look at... if you wait a minute, I'm going to get to that.
Sure.
Look at graph 67 and I'll give you some of the demographics. 70% are adults, 31% are children. Most of those children qualify for CHIP or Medicaid, but these are parents that have chosen to put their children in the private sector programs. In the group portion, 50% of the people in group enrollment are kids. Parents want their kids with them in the group market. Average age overall is about 34. Individual market is a little bit older. In OMIP, the average age is 70% female. So when you look up there on slide 66 and you see about 800 folks enrolled in OMIP, 70% are female, average age is a little over 50 years old. You really have two distinct populations, the older uninsured and then the young families trying to find insurance. Male, 36%, female, 64%.
Is that the adults or the children or combined? Adults, children, or combined, male?
In the male and female ratios?
Yeah.
Yes, they are, Representative March.
Yes, they are. Adults.
Combined.
They're combined. You can begin to see some of the costs on slide 68, and I'll really have you look at the middle slide, average subsidy, and why we're putting people in group coverage as opposed to individual. The average cost is about $84 per individual per month in group coverage from the subsidy standpoint. In the individual non-OMIP, that is the non-high-risk pool folks, it's $164. And in OMIP, it's $314, which is not a bad price for 50-year-old female, chronic health conditions, diabetes, cancer, MS, whatever it may be. If you look at the third bullet there, average member, employer, in the group market, the individual's putting in $13.44 per member per month. The employer for the group market is putting in about $90, so it's almost a 50-50 split. State's putting up 50, of which either 28 cents on the dollar or 40 cents on the dollar state dollars. There's a lot of federal dollars there. The employer's putting up $90. Individual non-OMIP, $17 per individual, and for OMIP, it's about 34. And that's on top of the co-pays and the deductibles.
I'm sorry, Rocky, could you go through that group employer, $90.08 a month? State's putting up 50 of that 90?
Mr. Chair,
combination
group
state
employer,
federal.
That's the employer's portion of the premium. They're putting up about 50 cents on the dollar. If you look up the slide up above that, average subsidy, the group, we're paying 83, the employer's paying 90.
Okay.
So it really costs $170.
Go ahead. I got it.
Cost 170. Now, one thing is most of those plans, we do not pay for dental. Except when it's a part of the comprehensive plan. There are a lot of, some of these include dental and vision coverage. Some of them don't. So it's kind of apples and oranges when you try to compare some of the benefits. And the enrollment projections, and Representative Cruz, I hope that answered your question about the group versus individual and why the group. It's just so much more economically feasible if we can get the enrollment. Finally, the enrollment projections under the governor's balanced budget would take us from our current 4,200 to about 4,600, and we hope to do that over the next 12 months. The primary challenge, again, in the group market. It is 4:30, Mr. Chair, and...
Keep going.
Keep going. Well, that is about it, Ms. Chair, on the last slide. We've talked about the employer mandates, I think, earlier when Joel was here, and I will interject a little piece of humor that somebody said it was the Rocky and Joel Winkle show, but that's another issue. For those of you who remember Joel Winkle. We've talked a little bit about the insurance mandates, so I, you know, unless you had questions on that, I would slip to the last slide, which is I'm hoping Bob DePreet does provide you with a list of state by state. But I want to close by saying every state is in the same position almost. I think Wyoming and New Jersey or someplace probably are different. I don't know, but state after state is having to cut Medicaid benefits. State after state is having to cut eligibility. There are a number of states that have innovative programs like ours that are trying to get what they call HIPAA waivers. New Mexico. We've got Washington. We've got Massachusetts that are trying to do things in the private sector. And part of this is coming from signals from the federal government and the Bush administration. They want to see some innovation and some expansion in the private sector, that it dovetails with some of their initiatives around tax credits and helping small businesses afford health insurance, around some of the legislation around MSAs and HRAs. But it is a tough time right now for all states. Every state is in the same kind of predicament. When you look at Medicaid expenditures, it's a line like this. When you look at state revenues, it's a line like this. Tough decisions and a lot of little programs to see if they work are being looked at in a variety of different states. But Oregon is really one of the few true group and individual market private sector HIPAA waivers. A lot of them, it's really expansion or changes to some of their Medicaid programs. But Oregon's model is I think, a true private sector HIPAA waiver, and a lot of people are looking to see if it works. I just think this has been a great opportunity, Mr. Chair, and want to thank you and members of the committee for putting up with me for 4 days and all the questions, and Peggy and some of the folks back there that helped come up and save me and some of the answers. It's been a good couple of days.
Well, thank you, but you're not done yet, because I put the muzzle on the ponies here, and I'm sure they've got questions, as do I. Representative Mark.
Thank you. When you were discussing the challenges and opportunities, you mentioned it was worthwhile to pay 80% on the group or $80 on the group market. That was referring to our subsidy that we pay here. Also, under the OMIP program, do we pay an agent referral fee for people who write that letter that says this person won't qualify for or will be rejected for insurance? I mean, does the state pay agents out there a referral fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, yes, they do. Yeah. Any accepted enrollment into FEOP, we will pay an agent referral fee.
To FEOP and OMIP?
To OMIP. I'm sorry. FEOP pays no agent referral fee. FEOP pays no commissions. The agent community is out there working with those individuals to fill out the FEOP application, but gets no reimbursement. With OMIP, $75, whether it is a rejection, whether it's helping them with FEOP, whether it's writing the letter, whatever it may be. That is correct. The board, OMIP board, chose to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Your staff breathed a collective sigh of relief as you corrected yourself. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to follow up on that last question. So the agents, the 260 to 400 people that you've trained recently, they're just doing it as a service to these folks.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is no commission, no payout, other than what they may get from a company. What interest me? When we had to go out and train the agents, we had to tell them what's in it for them. Well, they're working with an employer. Employers having trouble meeting participation requirements and dependent coverage. This is a way to get more people enrolled in dependent coverage so the employer can maintain that requirement with the carrier. If it's an individual, they can get their, if it's a $300 a month individual plan, they can get their $24 or $20 a month for as long as somebody's in the plan. From the carrier, they're not going to get anything from us. But this is really being done by, I think, an industry and agent associations that are committed to trying to get people insured. There's some payoff, sometimes there's none.
Future doesn't.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You referred to your waiting list. Is everything a first come, first serve arrangement? Or is there any sort of preference given to people based on their condition?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, what are you doing? It is. It is a first-come, first-serve. And except that we divide group and individual, because we have a certain number of group slots, certain number of individual groups open. Individual, it's first-come, first-serve basis. Now, let me tell you that when we first started this program, we had five different advocate groups all sitting in front saying, MS Association, we want them to get it. People with kids, we want the kids to get it. It was very difficult for us to make adjustment who's vulnerable and who's not, who's more and others. So we finally just said, we know we got 100,000 out there. Let's just make it first come. We have not marketed the individual side from 98 until this last couple months. So all the reservation lists that we have, very old list. And one of the things you'll see on there is that we're actually sending out information and applications to about 7,000 or 8,000. We're going to try to do it to everybody. Our sense is when you've been on that reservation list for a year, you've moved, you've changed jobs, because FEOP is just like Medicaid. It is a transitional support program. Most people in this state are covered by group coverage, and eventually you're going to end up in group coverage, and hopefully with an employer that pays the premium. So not all these folks get into this program and stay forever. It's just a support system. Hopefully they earn more money and they don't qualify. So we're finding out that a large percentage of these that have been on for 6 months or more may or may not even return an application.
Rocky, help clarify for me this: the group versus the individual market wait list. I mean, I don't understand why one in the group you're having trouble putting people in the group versus the individual.
Mr. Chair, first of all, and I don't have the figures in front of me, so these are estimates.
But just I don't need, the numbers so much aren't important. It's what's the dynamic that's creating, you know, the wait list for the one or for the group and not the individual.
First is, I think, getting the message out there. In the individual market, usually you have people that are looking to try to figure out, buy, and get health insurance. In the group market, very often you have the employee already covered, and it's family members. So your target isn't necessarily somebody who's out there being the one that buys it. Secondly is you have just the maze of understanding it. An employer has to provide information. In terms of the health benefit plans, payroll deductions, and all of that. So just getting through that administrative process with employers. You have the problems of open enrollment. You know, in the state of Oregon, if you decline health insurance and change your mind, this gets kind of to your question earlier, say, whoops, I have health care needs, I want it now. The answer is no. You got to wait till your open enrollment, which is October of each year, effective January 1. I will say the carriers have stepped up and said, we have no objections to open enrollment as far as the carriers are concerned. But from an employer's perspective, if they've budgeted so much contribution for their share, they don't want people moving in and out. And partly just from an equity issue. Here's somebody for FEOP. We're going to let come in anytime they want into our employer plan, but from somebody that's not FEOP, I think somebody said today we had 100, and I was talking with our eligibility supervisor, 115 applications, which represents probably 200 to 250 enrollments that we have already approved in the last month that are just waiting for an open enrollment period. The employer says, no, I'm not going to treat you any different than anybody else. Wait to the open enrollment when that occurs. So just a variety of dynamics. Part of it is we don't know where they are. We have to go to the employers. We're doing the best we can. We're working with Lisa Tressel from AOI and those folks. We're working with the agent associations. And we hope over the next 3 or 4 months that we're going to be able to zero down and target those businesses where we know that there's a lot of people uninsured because of their inability to afford the premiums.
So, I mean, functionally you're saying that group market, it's a smaller market. And actually getting into it, even once you identify members, may be more cumbersome in terms of the communication requirements. You might be displacing some already covered people if they were willing to wait. They made the decision, hey, we can't afford this anymore. I mean, I understand what you're saying. Could you flip back to slide 68 and tell me, I'm a member, or not? I'm not a member. Well, let's assume I'm just a signed-up member for FEOP. Go down this. What am I going to pay a month?
Okay, Mr. Chair,
let's just come up with a standard, you know, married, two kids.
On average. Let's say
on average.
This is on average. Let's say that you're in the group market.
Okay.
You will pay $13.44. I will pay $83.74.
Wait a minute. Where am I seeing the 13?
Average member employer contribution, bottom. See where it says group member?
Okay.
$13.44. That's what you are going to pay.
As an employer.
Employee.
Employer.
That says employer.
No. You got
member.
You
member or employer.
Member, and then you have employer.
Okay.
Employer's going to pay $90.08.
Okay.
You're going to pay as an employee $13.44. And as a state, I'm going to pay, the subsidy is going to be $83.74.
On top of everything that's listed there.
If I would take you to Section 1, page 23, that's going to be the easiest place to see it. Section 1 of your book, not the slide, page 23. And if you come down to group market, excluding self-insured and co-reportability, which is the last section, you'll see where it says member contribution, subsidy per month, premium per month, employer contribution.
Okay. So round numbers, this whole deal, the state, the employer, and the employee is costing $200 a month.
$197.
And part of that is paid by the
employer, feds, individual, and state.
That answers that question.
And if it's the individual, then all you have to do is take out the employer contribution, because there's no contribution from the employer. So then you'll have the individual, the state, which include, and then the feds. I always want to caution you, this is not including co-pays and deductibles.
Right. Any other questions for Mr. King?
Well, go ahead.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may be a little bit off the subject, but I've been noticing locally Southern Oregon advertisements by some of the local agents for children's health care for $50 a month.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, you can get plans for children for $50 a month. I don't know what the benefit
is. Individual private insurance.
You can get individual private health insurance. Again, I don't know what the benefit. That could be a $200 deductible or a $5,000 deductible.
Okay. But it's not for a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we're not advertising that way. You've heard our advertising. It's primarily been on television. It's Bill Shonley does our ads that through a great arrangements that Greg Walden set up for us years ago with the Broadcasters Association. And he does kind of a family health insurance assistance program. If you're in a small employer or can't afford your employer's premium, call us. And then we do some radio under that same scholarship program through the Oregon Broadcasters. Only advertising we do.
Go ahead. Gordon. One further question. There are a number of, I think they're faith-based plans like MediShare. I've seen that advertised where they're, they could claim 150,000 people covered, where...
In the state of Oregon?
They're national. They're national. Where you put in either a very small amount per month or where they call you when someone in your plan has gotten ill, say they have a $50,000 expense, then they notify 5,000 people that you put in $10 a month or 500 people put in $100 a month. Do those type plans tend to affect you in that they take, because they do have, if I understand correctly, and I haven't looked into it thoroughly, they do have some pretty good qualifications, no high blood pressure, no diabetes. Do those hurt your plan, essentially, or are they just another help in the whole, in the total market?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, first of all, I hope I'm not in competition with anybody. I want everybody in this state to be covered and to get access. There are a lot of companies out there. I hate to say negatively about this man, but I call them the ArtLink letters of the world companies, because you see all these little call us and send you $15 a month for the rest of your life, and I'll give you $10 when you die kind of stuff. There are a lot of companies out there that provide minimal benefits for very very high costs. But remember, you only get what you pay for. If you're paying $5, I guarantee you, you're not getting $6 worth of benefit. There are no silver magic bullets out there. There are a lot of pay $5, get $2 benefits. I mean, that's why Maxi and the insurance division are out there regulating insurers, is to keep that from happening. But I'm not in competition with anybody. And I don't think they hurt us. I just think there are some deals out there that aren't very good for Oregon citizens when they put up the money.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of these is, Rick, I think in the future, probably for all the programs, I'd like to look at the budgets in fair detail because it kind of know where the costs are going will help me understand the programs. And then in particular, you mentioned we have currently about 9,300 people on OMIP. And what is the turnover? I'd be interested in the turnover, because at 9,300 people at $75 a referral, that's nearly $700,000. And, you know, whether I'd like to know what kind of a, also like to know what kind of a, whether the board, your advisory board or OMIP board considered maybe a split referral fee procedure, whereby if someone is goes to an agent's turned down and then the agent refers them back over to OMIP would be, say, $75, and whereas if the agent makes the determination themselves and just writes a letter, it would be lesser. So be interested in knowing how much you've actually paid out in referral fees and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, we'll give you that information, the detailed budget, because you also asked for some claims information about OMIP.
Right.
I will tell you that the agent referral fees are significant. Out of $5 million a month expenditures, I pay out about $15,000 in agent referral fees. And I view that as significant. When years ago it used to be 5,000. The difference is I'm getting 400 applications. About half of those come in with an agent referral fee, or that are eligible for an agent referral fee. So, you know, $15,000 a month is a lot of dough to spend on the agent community. In the grand scheme of things, out of $5 million, maybe not, but it's still significant.
But at the same time, I mean, you're talking about OMIP. I mean, remember, that agent went to this individual or that business, and it wasn't going to qualify. I mean,
if they did that, but if they just said, oh, well, you're not going to qualify, and wrote the letter, I mean, there's a difference in level of effort, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative March, I will tell you that I can't speak for all the agents, but by and large, these agents will put in from 2 hours to 2 days worth of work on every single one, whether they write the letter or not. That means meeting with them, going to their homes, filling out applications, reviewing those. It takes you just 2 hours to fill out the application. There are some agents, though, that sign their name in the back, check off, send me $75, and here, fill this out and send it in to them. And we are actually trying to really narrow that down, and we watch for patterns of agents. We know which agents get referral fees, ones that don't, and we keep track of that. But it's not. I'm a big supporter of a lot of these agents that spend hours and hours and hours with these folks, trying to find them coverage, whether through the group carrier or group market, employer, or the individual. So it's really the minority that I think maybe take advantage of it.
And it's probably fair to say that if the agent was able to place it with a private carrier, he or she would get a larger check than $75.
Mr. Chair, if you want somebody in the private sector for a year versus somebody in OMIP, one-time payment, one-time only, I will tell you they will take private sector anytime. Where they make their money is by servicing that people, and somewhere down the line, some other family member or that individual finally converts to regular coverage.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's an opportunity for abuse there. You know, you can't write enough laws to prevent that kind of abuse. I mean, I think they're incented to do as good a job as they can to get them into the private sector. Here's the fallback. Is that a question?
No, it's a microphone.
Well, just the way you were...
Well, Mr. Chair, you kind of made my point. We often in government craft policy to deal with a bad actor rather than exceptions to deal with a bad actor, and craft policy to allow the good actors to do their job in a prudent manner. So I understand, Representative Marsh, I understand your concern there, but I doubt if there's very many insurance agents that are looking at that $75 as their ticket to Hawaii.
Yeah, it's my ticket to the
ten of them would
Tumalo
do it.
Dairy Queen.
ten of them would do it.
Yeah, Chair, I'm interested in legislation that could involve some of us in profit sharing on that, though. That would be nice.
Yeah. Any other questions for Rocky? Well, on behalf of the committee, let me sincerely thank you and your staff. We have achieved a new standard. The King, DePreet, Goldberg standard. I pity those Mr. that are going Chair. To follow you in terms of yeah. your superb. Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair. I think it would be appropriate before Rocky leaves that you offer him a cookie.
Well, that's, I helped him staple some of the material together. That's as far as I'm going to go. See no other business come before the committee? We are adjourned.